Good morning, everyone. Very pleased to have all of you here. And we're very pleased to have with us today the Deputy Secretary General, Jan Eliasson, and then Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, who's here to present this report, Global Estimates 2014, which I guess there are some copies of available at the entryway there if you want to pick that up. And now, without further ado, I'll turn the floor over to the Deputy Secretary General. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Farhan. Very good to see you this beautiful fall morning. Scandinavian weather, I would say, Jan. And I'm very glad, as you understand, to meet with my friend Jan Egeland, who was also one of my successors as emergency relief coordinator some years ago for me, and not so many years for you. Mm-hmm. And I had a great story when I left this job as emergency relief coordinator. There was a reception, and I was thanked profusely. I tried to look slightly embarrassed, but it was very nice to hear it. Until the last line, where the lady says, "And now let us introduce to the floor, to the podium, Mr. Eliasson, emergency coordinator, responsible for all disasters in the world." I felt that was somewhat unfair. You were really out there in the field doing a great job for the UN, and we're glad that you are now the SG of the Norwegian Refugee Council. This is a very important report from the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, IDCM, and it helps us understand some of the most pressing global challenges. That is, how we better prevent one, how we secondly prepare for, and third, find solutions to the displacements of millions of people caused by natural disasters each year. And Jan will tell you the rather scary, worrying statistics about the growth of these numbers. In 2009, this IDMC produced its first report together with OCHA with global estimates of the scale and nature of displacement, such as floods, storms, and earthquakes. And over the last years, the data analysis in these yearly reports have helped us monitor how we are protecting and supporting people displaced by disasters. This year's report is extremely timely. As we prepare for the SG's climate summit next week, the devastating impact of disasters and the massive displacement we see as a result highlight the need for strong and decisive action to tackle the catastrophic threat of climate change. The risk of displacement due to disasters has more than doubled over the last four decades, and the report shows a long-term trend of increasing displacement driven by population pressures and vulnerability to natural hazards. In 2013, IDMC estimates that 22 million people were displaced in 119 countries. 22 million people, I repeat, were displaced in 119 countries as a result of natural disasters. That is almost three times as many people who were internally displaced by conflict and violence in the same period. In today's world of increasing and intensifying disasters, early warning systems and emergency evacuations will become ever more important, as we've seen around the world recently. We also need to be more prepared for displacement caused by climate change, as I said. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has asked world leaders next week to bring bold announcements and actions to the climate summit, September 23. Let us ensure that we include mechanisms for early warning and that we devise responses for those who have been displaced by disasters and climate change. The numbers of people who need humanitarian assistance and the cost of helping them are skyrocketing. We need to shift our focus to prevention and preparedness in close cooperation with national partners. The timing is right for this change of approach. The world is gearing up to create for a new post-2015 global development framework where poverty reduction and sustainable development are to be closely integrated. The coming negotiations present an opportunity to ensure that the needs of IDPs are taken into account. Lastly, in March next year, 14th to 18th of March, we will also have the Third World Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction to be hosted by Japan in Sendai, city of Sendai. This conference will be a major opportunity to formulate our global action plan for responding to and preventing disasters. We need really to work very hard, much harder on disaster risk reduction. And finally, we have the opportunity of the World Humanitarian Summit in 2016 in Turkey, where the prevention of and response to disaster-induced displacement should be at the heart of considerations. Thank you very much. I now leave the floor to Jan Egeland to brief on the report. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Jan, for being here at the launch of this important report, which is the Global Estimates 2014. This is done by my colleagues in the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center of the Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC. It's a group of some 30 researchers that represent the world's leading capacity in monitoring, documenting, and researching on internal displacement, both conflicts and natural disasters. So earlier this year, we launched a report that found that 33 million people had been accumulated as conflict displaced in the world, and 8 of those millions were displaced only in 2013 from conflict. Now we have a report saying that indeed, 22 million, three times the number of conflict displaced, internally displaced, have been displaced by natural disasters. Most people have not woken up to the fact that disasters, natural disasters, floods, hurricanes, earthquakes, displace many more people than all wars and conflicts combined. The map shows which are the most disaster-prone countries, those in deep orange, and those who have the highest proportion to population are the ones with stripes in Africa. Now, what are the trends? And this is, for the first time, we have now documented the longer-term trend. So, as you will see, from year to year, it varies wildly, enormously, from country to from year to year, from 2008 to 2013. Average 27 million per year the last 5 years. We relate that to the last four decades, and we see a relentless increase. Four times more people in absolute numbers are displaced now compared to the 1970s, four times more. If we then compare that to a doubled world population, we see that a person today is twice as likely to be displaced by natural disasters as somebody living in the 1970s. Why is this? Because many more people live more exposed to natural disasters. And perhaps the most important variable is that urbanization has happened in a bad way in very disaster-prone areas. So the slums of the big cities, of growing cities, become traps for people that are exposed to natural disasters. Where are people displaced? Well, it's in Asia. 81% of all people displaced were in Asia. And half of the 20 biggest displacement events were in two countries alone, China and the Philippines. Philippines being particularly vulnerable. 7 million people displaced all in all in that country by three enormous catastrophes. The two hurricanes, Haiyan being the biggest, but also an earthquake on top of that. We do expect the numbers to increase quite dramatically with the current trend in Africa, as also Africa is experiencing this enormous population growth, and urbanization there as well. Now, there is this lethal mix now between conflict and disasters. So we see that the most disaster-prone countries often have a very active and horrific war on top of that. Many are not would not be aware that in the Philippines, 370,000 people, 327,000 people were displaced by conflict on top of the 7.2 million that was displaced by natural disasters. Nigeria had 500,000 displaced by conflict. It also had 117,000 from natural disasters. We have to get people out of this deadly trap of vulnerability, disasters, and conflict. Let me then end by saying, what is the message here? I think the message is, as the Deputy Secretary General just said, to world leaders coming to the climate summit on Tuesday, we say the following. Natural disaster displacement has gone through the roof with population growth and increasing vulnerability because more people are exposed to natural disasters. It will be accelerating now with more extreme weather being produced by climate change. Is it hopeless? No. You can see on the T-shirt of the man who's carrying his little belongings out of Tacloban in Philippines, his T-shirt says, never give up. We mustn't give up because it's possible to make people disaster resilient. Many countries have become much more disaster resilient. People can be unlocked from the vicious cycle of vulnerability, being displaced by disaster, becoming more vulnerable, therefore more easily again displaced by the next disaster, and then be engulfed in conflict. Of course, the message is also climate change can be stopped. That's the main message of the summit. And we should all remember that those who did nothing to cause climate change are first and hardest hit now by natural disasters. It's the poor people in the places there were no emissions. We who cause climate change are least and last hit. It's the injustice of the century, and it can be corrected. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And if you'll all please identify yourselves. I know many of you had asked Mr. Eglan questions years before, but if you can reintroduce yourselves to him, that would be great. And speak into the microphones. Yes, Karaman.
Thank you, Farhan. Mr. DSG, Mr. Eglan, thank you very much on behalf of the UN Correspondents Association for this briefing. Mr. DSG, my first question goes to you. The numbers here are quite scary, and when we look at it, in the coming years, in the long term, what are you going to tell the world leaders to do to decrease these numbers during the climate summit and during the following summits that are upcoming, including the 2016 event that will be held in Turkey, the event in Japan? What are you going to tell the world leaders to do? Can you kind of give us the roadmap on that? Mr. Eglan, my question to you is, you raised an interesting point connecting the more peaceful world in a less world that is exposed to natural disaster, if I understood correctly. Can you open that up a little bit? Are you saying that if there is less war, people will be more protected from natural disasters? Can you talk a little bit about that? Thank you.
I think we will try to convey to the member states that climate change is happening now, every day, that we are seeing a pattern of aggravated floods and storms and hurricanes, which are clearly to also by most scientists accepted, related to climate change. And that we, by that, we'll underline the importance of taking steps to fight climate change and to aim for and deliver on the 2-degree target that we have. I think this is a constant reminder. And then to me, I've lived my life trying to do more on prevention. I think we need to do everything we can to prevent these disasters from becoming so serious. Man, unfortunately, has acted in such a way that these disasters also have been made more serious by deforestation and a few other things that can be mentioned. Jan knows that better than I. And I think, therefore, this work on disaster risk reduction, the meeting in Japan next year, is absolutely crucial. The last point I'd like to make is what Jan Egeland said at the end, that it is the poorest people that pay the price most of the time in natural disasters. In Haiti, it was those who had the worst structured buildings who died, while if it were to have happened in a country which was a rich country, you would have been living in different buildings. So the poor pay the price. One of my most traumatic experiences when I was in Jan's job as emergency relief coordinator was when I came to Bangladesh after the absolutely horrifying cyclone wave that had drowned 120,000 people in 45 minutes back in those days. And when I realized that those who had died were very much those who lived in the most risky areas of Bangladesh, they planted their rice even in places which did not exist on the land map. So they were the ones taking the biggest risks, and they were the ones swept away by this cyclone wave. That was, to me, a tremendous wake-up call for the poorest, really, who pay the price for also natural disasters. After that, I would say Bangladesh has done a fantastic job in warning signals and warning systems that were set up.
Thank you. 33 of the 36 countries that have armed conflict have natural disaster displacement as well. Is there a relationship between the two? Yes, I think so. I think it becomes more difficult to make peace in countries like Somalia because people are time and again devastated by natural disasters. And it's more difficult to make people resistant to the natural disasters also because there is conflict. It's this vicious cycle. Is it possible to break the cycle? Yes, it is possible to break the cycle. In many ways, we've already done that for saving lives. The number of people losing their life in natural disasters have gone down. Where we fail is to give them life and hope by getting them out of this of the vicious cycle. And that's the call for world leaders. Invest in getting Somalia and other places out of the vicious cycle here.
Siapak?
Hi, jeg heter Siapak. Jeg fra Scan News, og så jeg flytning fra Iran til Norge. Det veldig hyggelig å møte dere. Questions. We always hear about disasters, and then the timing to reach the point, it's always quite long. What's wrong with having, since we can locate, kind of putting the map, where are the disasters usually happening, what's wrong with having camps around those areas or nearby those areas in order to save life, to save time, and to save money as well, because always there are questions that we don't have enough money, we cannot reach them on time. My other question, if I may, it's since I'm a refugee myself as well, there's such a problem between the refugees and the host country always to understand each other. What do we do in order to make that gap narrower, smaller, and then hopefully vanish? So there won't be any gap between the refugees and then the host country so they can understand each other much better. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Now, the one of the findings we've had in our two reports, both on conflict displacement and by natural disaster displacement, is that people stay longer and longer in displacement that we don't get them out of displacement. 17 years on average for conflict displacement people. I don't think we have the exact number of years for disaster victims, but people are still in displacement in Haiti many years after the earthquake, for example. So we have to get them back and into a durable solution, either a return and rebuilding of their home or resettlement elsewhere, whether they are natural disaster victims or a conflict victims. The best is always return to the place of origin. The second best is within the region, and the third best is resettlement elsewhere. But there has to be a durable solution, and we're failing in doing that. True, the numbers accumulating. The host communities has to be given more help, really. We see in too many places that the displaced, when they get emergency relief, are at least as well off as the totally impoverished local populations, and there may be tension between the two unless we also provide for the host community and the host population. So that's what we're trying to do more, and we're always appealing for money also for the host the host populations. Evelyn?
Good to see you two again. Welcome back, Mr. Eglin. Evelyn Leopold, Huffington Post contributor. You mentioned that losing lives in natural disasters gone down. Why is that? And my second question is, we are filled with areas of conflict in every single briefing. We have Central African Republic, we have Syria, Iraq, South Sudan, and on it goes. And you mentioned Somalia. Has this raised your? Will this raise your numbers in 2014? The amount of conflicts that we haven't seen before, because I didn't see the estimate. I saw it up to 2013 here.
Thanks. Now the good to see you again, Evelyn. Remember the old days. In terms of conflict disasters, conflict displacement, the UNHCR and NRC is combining the figures for refugees and internally displaced, and we exceeded 50 million for conflict displacement for the first time since the aftermath of the Second World War, and that will definitely go up. In terms of disaster displacement, it's only the newly displaced we record from year to year. The accumulative numbers, they're also going through the roof, but it's often hard to say when are you not anymore displaced from a disaster, when have you become a slum dweller in a new city, for example. That figure is also going up. And climate change will fuel it further. Is it hopeless? No, because there are many countries that have actually gotten out both of conflict displacement and natural disaster displacement. It is too bad, really, that these top 20 countries were not able to fix it. And again, this is the message to world leaders. We have 180 nations. Help the 20 nations that are in that tremendous lethal mix of conflict and disaster displacement.
Matthew.
My other question was you mentioned losing lives in natural disasters.
Indeed. I think, well, there can be various factors, but one of them is definitely that disaster preparedness has gotten better. People are evacuated better now. Bangladesh is such a place where I remember in the old days where we had these tremendous loss of lives due to recurrent flooding. Now people are moved to shelters. They save their lives. So evacuation is better, preparedness is better, and life-saving humanitarian assistance is better. What is not better is, in a way, disaster risk reduction, development for these people. We save their lives. We do not give them life and hope.
Okay. Thanks. Matthew Lee, Intercity Press, on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access. Thanks for the briefing. And I wanted to ask about another side of this conflict and disaster connection. And it involves, uses an example, Sri Lanka, where the idea is that people are displaced. The question is, what does the international system do to make sure that people that are displaced have a right to return to where they came from? You have issues of, you have ethnic conflicts where a majority doesn't want a minority to return. Hmm. This even came up in the United States after Katrina. Many people said that coastal area, that some of the most, the best areas people couldn't return to, and they were turning to hotels and other things. So I guess, what's the interplay between displacement by disaster and governmental policies that may not treat those displaced fairly? And then I wanted to ask the Deputy Secretary General about South Sudan. I know that there's a whole section of the report on South Sudan and conflict and natural disaster. But what is the UN system doing to sort of help this new country deal with future floods? Like, it seems like everything is kind of there are emergency appeals, but what can be done when you have a big peacekeeping mission on the ground and a lot of focus, at least for now, among donors to try to make things better in the future? Thanks.
Why don't you start?
Okay. It is very much true that too often there are legal issues that are unresolved for the internally displaced, and that is both for conflict and for disaster. That is why one of the main programs of the Norwegian Refugee Council is our Information Counseling and Legal Assistance Program. We give free legal advice to thousands and thousands of refugee and displacement families, and that is especially in relation to housing, land, and property. Very often they are robbed of their land, they are robbed of their property, and they are robbed of their legal status. And women are especially exposed, single mother households especially. There is a very difficult issue that has come back time and again to people living in a horrifically disaster-prone area along the tsunami beaches of Indonesia or Sri Lanka, for example, and wanting to go back there. And then the government saying, no, we have a 100-meter now zone, which is too disaster-prone. You cannot go back there. Then people say, but where do we go then? And then people say, wait and see. And it goes on forever. Governments have to give people a better alternative if they take away the place where they originally lived. And it's often not happening.
On South Sudan, we are primarily trying to, of course, prevent conflict to erupt even more in a more violent way than it is today. That is perhaps our number one priority. But another priority that comes up and is on the same level now is to deal with the hugely dangerous humanitarian crisis in South Sudan. We have, when I talked to my friends in Ocha, and the SG came back from his trip, I remember a line that if we don't act now to prevent this humanitarian crisis from go deeper, by the end of this year, half of the population of South Sudan will be either refugees, internally displaced, starving, or dead. We have a huge humanitarian crisis. So I know on top of this comes now also floods. And we, of course, see that as another hugely complicating, tragic factor. But we haven't even enough money to do what we need to do for the humanitarian programs. I wish we could do more to deal with the floods issues and, above all, to make sure that they don't have the same vehement effects as they have every year. But I must admit that the two primary objectives will be to prevent this conflict from turning into what was very much a danger some months ago or a year ago. And then secondly, to make sure that people are not landing in these four categories that I mentioned. We should do more, but we simply don't have the resources.
Yes, in the back.
Hi, Trenton Daniel, Associated Press. I have two questions. The first one is about the numbers, and I was wondering, it notes that from 2008 to 2013 that there was an average of 27 million people who were displaced. And then in 1970, it says that in absolute terms, the risk of displacement is estimated to have more than doubled in four decades. So I'm wondering, I mean, can you give a little bit more info in terms of what's transpired from 1970 until 2013? You know, like, are there any places in particular where there was a high number of IDPs? And, you know, what were the reasons for that? Second question I have is about Haiti. And after the earthquake in 2010, there were, you know, IOM said about 1.5 million people were displaced. And that number has gone down significantly since then. It's probably around 100,000 or so, according to IOM. And that number was brought down through because of rental subsidies, evictions, like various reasons. But people's lives, you know, maybe they've improved, maybe they've not. People have moved into the hills, you know, in the countryside, or have left the city. So my question is, you know, and to go back for a second, I mean, you know, many governments will cite these IDP numbers as evidence of success. So, but maybe their lives are not really getting all that better, the people. So I'm wondering, you know, I mean, what can be done to ensure that people's lives, you know, the lives of IDPs are, I guess, better than they were when they were in the camps? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The first one is the trends since the 1970s. And yes, it was a big job. You will find in the report more details on it. Big job for our team here present, a part of it, to look at each and every year since the beginning of the 1970s and up until today. So the curve says the absolute number of people has gone up from less than 10 million on average displaced by natural disasters in the beginning of the 1970s to nearly 30 million per year now, the last five-year period, 27 million on average the last 5 years. So there is a quadrupling of the total absolute number that are being displaced. In the same period, world population has more or less exactly doubled. Of that population, but then we also see that people have accumulated much more in urban centers than in the countryside, and especially in the poor world. So more than 300% increase of urban centers in developing countries since the 1970s. That is the main explanatory factor for why you are twice the risk of being displaced if you're born today than if you were born in 1970s. Top of that comes now accelerating extreme weather due to climate change, which is not documented so clearly up until now. It will come. IPCC says it will come. It is happening, and it will be accelerating. I would just also say to you that it's very clear that those who end up in camps or informal gatherings that they're often happening, like in Haiti and elsewhere, in the end return, they are not getting better, a better deal than before. Remember, Bill Clinton said, we have to build back better. Yeah. Build back better. That was the slogan of the tsunami. And we had $13 billion to build back better after the tsunami. I led the effort at the time. It was fantastic. We had enough money to do build back better for everybody. In most of these cases, we do not. We do not build back better. We build back more vulnerability, and they are displaced again and again and again. And that's, again, the message to the World Summit. We need to have more economies investing more in building a more robust world for these the few hundreds of millions of people who are most risk exposed.
I would like to add something here also, yeah, because maybe we are also hiding figures, because if you look at the occurrence of droughts and floods, they are taking on structural character, which means already people have relocated. One of the reasons for urbanization in Africa and Asia is very much this danger. People move from areas with constant drought. They move from areas where floods reoccur all the time. So if it was a dramatic one-time event, they would be IDPs. But they have moved because they see this happening every year. They can't make a living. So this is related also to this structural phenomenon that we need to take into account. So the figures are probably much, much bigger. If we were to decide to really make peace with nature, people would not have left and moved away from these areas which are so vulnerable. You hear already when I speak to friends from small islands, with the rising sea level, the outer islands in the Maldives and Marshall Islands, I think, they're already almost inhabitable because the salt water gets into the fresh water, then people move away from that. You can imagine what that means for the coastal areas of, for instance, the subcontinent, in terms of future need for move. So this needs also to be seen in that context, that it's a long-term structural problem.
Matthew from Yomir.
Hello, my name is Matthew Carpenter. I'm a reporter for Yomiuri Shimbun, a Japanese newspaper. I have a question for Deputy Secretary General Eliasson. You said that urbanization is increasing. Now, in Japan, in the 2011 tsunami, one of the problems was local municipalities were so totally destroyed, aid agencies could not go in and work with local government to provide aid, which hampered the delivery of aid. If urbanization continues, I would see this would become an increasing problem in the future. How can the UN system best react to this?
Well, I think this is not only a challenge, an issue for the UN system. It's a challenge for all governments and state governments, local governments. We need to take this into account. I would say particularly cities in low-lying areas close to the seas probably need to take this into account. The debate started here. Remember when Sandy occurred? You heard both Mayor Bloomberg and Governor Cuomo talking about what climate change means, when you saw the southern tip of Manhattan flooded and the streets up to whatever, 30th Street, then you realize that this is a problem for all of us. So I think it's something that has to be taken seriously on all levels.
Okay. Yes. Yes, you.
I'm Greg Beck from Tokyo Broadcasting System. My question was, the Deputy Secretary General said that prevention, in particular in regards to climate change, is important in preventing displaced people before they happen, and you have this upcoming meeting in Sendai. What are your views on the role of nuclear energy in climate change and prevention?
I don't feel like going into that subject. I don't connect it immediately to prevention, but I see your point. But I really have nothing to add to the discussion about nuclear.
Mr. Eaglin?
Also, I couldn't really say. It's a controversial issue in very many nations. What we say is the general one. We have to go in a greener direction in energy. Is nuclear part of that? I don't know.
Okay. Yes, please, in the center.
Thank you for the briefing. Julia Sabie with Al Hayat. You mentioned Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is urging world leaders to make bold announcements at the climate summit. Is there any way, any monitoring mechanism to ensure that these world leaders follow up on their commitments? Is there any way to hold those most accountable for aggravating these natural disasters for the failure to commit. Thank you.
Well, the meeting will take place next week. It is meant to be a wake-up call, call for higher attention early on to the commitments that need to be made primarily in the process of the Lima meeting and the Paris meeting next year. But we will also add an element of a number of areas, 6 to 8 areas from transport to energy and areas where we are expecting to hear commitments about action taken. And we see a very positive trend both among governments and in terms of major companies to go in the direction of setting up a system of carbon pricing, which could have quite an important effect. When it comes to monitoring, this is something that we will be discussing at the meeting, but of course there is a need to follow up in different ways, and I cannot now say what the member states will decide to do, but I think it's mainly a national responsibility to do what is needed and what they will commit to at the meeting in next week, but also in terms of these practical areas, in those 6 to 8 areas that will be mentioned. We will, from our side, do our very best to monitor and follow this up. But I think it's mainly, again, responsibility back home. I think we need more and more to take away the borderline between national and international responsibility. If we are to be successful with international solutions, international formulas, they have to be taken seriously by member states. And I would say that in today's world, with the complex issues that we have at hand, the global challenges like climate or migration, name any of the global issues, I would say that the good international solution, the good international formula, is in today's world in the national interest. If we can come to that conclusion, that the good international solution, where we all give and take and come up with a common international formula, that is a national interest. If we can come to that conclusion, then we are home. Then we've done it. And I would try to take away that artificial line between international and national responsibility.
Anne Charles?
Yes, Anne Charles, Baltic Review. Although global displacement in Europe is relatively low, according to your report, what can you tell us about displacement caused by conflict and humanitarian disasters in European countries like Ukraine, which is now involved in a fragile ceasefire?
Well, conflict-related displacement in Ukraine is horrendous, really. We're talking about perhaps up to 1 million people now displaced within Ukraine or refugees into Russia. I think we have, to a lesser degree, documented natural disaster displacement in Ukraine. In our map, you will see that there is actually a number of disaster-prone European countries, and Germany was particularly hard hit 2013. But basically, all of the European countries had disaster displacement. The reason it's not as massive as in the Philippines or as in Africa or many other places is that Europe is disaster resilient. It has a good infrastructure. There are good preparedness. There is disaster risk reduction. But the fact that Germany is dark colored just shows that how tremendous the shocks are also there. Natural disasters do not discriminate between rich and poor countries, but the hazards do not discriminate. The reason the disasters are much more tougher in the poor countries is that people are so much more vulnerable. So it shows we need to get to these people. We need to have Somalia become as resistant to natural disasters like Norway is. A storm does not affect us that much in Norway. Should be the same in Somalia.
Yes, in the back. Last.
Thank you. I'm Christopher Ronenberg with the Norwegian newspaper Aftenposten. One question for each of you, if I may. First, to Mr. Egeland, you've been talking about, you mentioned briefly urbanization as one of the biggest factors in this. And obviously, urbanization is not going to end in developing countries, and neither is climate change. And I know this was touched on by the DSG previously, but how do you see cities, big cities in developing countries, tackling this issue? What's the best way to prevent or to decrease the vulnerability in the ever-increasing cities? And secondly, for the DSG, Mr. Eliasson, in some areas, or you will require collaboration from the local authorities if you are to prevent the impacts of natural disasters. You mentioned Bangladesh, that there's been a lot of good work there done on prevention. Just across the border in Myanmar, there are now camps of Rohingya people where if there was another typhoon like Nargis in 2008 happening there, it would be absolutely devastating. And obviously one of the major problems in that area is the lack of collaboration by the authorities. What can be done in areas such as those where it's difficult to actually get access? Thank you.
Now, it's interesting. Urbanization was actually mentioned by some of the reports, recent reports, that it can be one of the solutions in climate change context, because people will live in urban areas and do not need to use cars and all sorts of emissions through transport. But that presupposes good urbanization, planned urbanization, good transport, robust systems, a water supply that is functioning, and no flooding risk. Earthquake risk should not be where there is a megacity, etc. The problem is that urbanization happens now rapidly, especially in poor countries, totally unplanned. And some of the places that are cheapest for poor people and where they come together in densely populated, the land there is cheap precisely for the reason that it is disaster prone. There is flooding there. There is earthquakes there. So that has to change. How can it be changed? By governmental planning, and but also investment in better housing and not in the most disaster-prone areas. And it's back to this Sri Lanka case, if you like. If you have to give people a better future than the one they had, if you say you cannot go back to the place that are flooded all the time.
I could just add that I think a little bit over 50% today of the world's population live in urban areas. The forecast that I've heard is that by 2030 we will have almost 75% people of the 75% of the population living in cities. And here I think it's very important for city planners and for national governments to think of what I said earlier, the low-lying coastal areas and the dangers related to rising sea levels, but also the strain on infrastructure and the demands on infrastructure. Mostly the growth in urbanization is poor people moving into poor countries' major urban areas with great slums created. And we have in some of the major such areas even outbreaks of cholera these days, because of the lacking infrastructure related to sanitation. And this is a huge issue, the need to have the reasonable infrastructure to deal with this massive inflow of people and the need for good infrastructure. I would like to add that to Jan's good comment. In Bangladesh, I saw only a year after this horrible disaster back in 91, I saw immediate action taken on building shelters, much better warning system from the meteorological authorities, sirens and warning signals. So I think since then, Bangladesh has lost, maybe it's a big figure anyway, 1 to 2,000, I think. It's still a big figure, but not, you know, related to 120,000 people drowning in 45 minutes. It's something different. We had, of course, a disaster in Myanmar more recently, where there was problems of access. I think the Myanmari authorities drew some lessons from that, and we hope that with the new government we will have, if such cases will come up, that we will have cooperation. And I think that also the Myanmari authorities are moving in the direction of setting up such early warning systems. I would hope that we will do this, because I have been to that area, the Cox's Bazar area south there, and see the I don't know whether they are as large as when I was there negotiating the return of Rohingyas back in 1992, but that's a very thin strip of land very close to the coastal areas, so there you would have a problem related also to the refugees or the people who have left the country and are now in Bangladesh. But I think it's moving in the right direction.
Okay.
I think we should. I have a meeting at 12.
Yeah, I believe we're out of time. Mr. Eklund has kindly offered to stay on and be available for one-on-one interviews or further questions after this. But I'd like to thank Mr. Eklund, Mr. Eliasson, and all of you for participating.
I can offer you another joke here, off the record. that.
Yeah, on the record, by the way.
Yeah, you're on camera.
There's no return. Well, the joke was that I was Jan E., U.S. Chief of Humanitarian Affairs, followed by Jan E. In Humanitarian Affairs. So we said, there's a very limited group to recruit into this job. You have to be Jan E. From a very small company. In your case, even smaller. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much.
Everyone.